Welcome back. Today we are covering the retail sales report and it comes out in just about 20 seconds. We've got retail sales month over month expected to come in at 0.5 to the negative, excluding auto, 0.4 to the negative, excluding auto and gas, 0.6 to the negative. Let's see how bad it comes in. Worse is not necessarily a good thing here today. So let's see. All right, here we go. Retail sales advance. Wow, negative 1%. That's twice as bad as expected. Retail sales excluding auto month over month, also twice as bad as expected. Negative 0.8 instead of 0.4. Retail sales excluding auto and gas, negative 0.3. So a little less bad than expected. So the expectation there was negative 0.6. Retail sales control group, negative 0.3 instead of negative, 0.5%. Let's go ahead and get into what the actual details of this are. In the meantime, we also have an import price index that just came out. So we'll go through this as well. The import price index, let's see here. We've got for the import price index, month over month came in at negative 0.6. We are expecting negative 0.1. Import price index, excluding petroleum month over month, negative 0.6. The expectation was flat. Import price index year over year, negative 4.6. Expectation was negative 4.1. Export price index, negative 0.3. The expectation was flat. So you also had a slight revision up in the prior month from 0.4 on those retail sales advance month over month up to negative 0.2. But what does this mean? Well, what this means is things are finally starting to roll over and they're coming in weaker than any economist has really been projecting, or at least certainly the average or median set of economists are not expecting the numbers to be this bad. And the numbers are actually finally starting to come in this bad, which is a sign that, yeah, the Federal Reserve has potentially kept their boot on our necks for too long. And now all of a sudden the economy is, to some extent, starting to drown. So let's take a look at this. Advanced monthly sales for retail and food services. This is for March 2023. I just read off some of the big numbers. Here's that revision that was negative 0.4 for February. But this is now falling substantially. We've gone through some of the headline numbers. So let's see if we can get some charts and some details here. Here we go. All right. So we're going to look at, let's look at the adjusted on the right side, 2023 March. So we're going to go, just to make this a little easier, put a little box around the column we're going to look at. All right, what do we have? So it looks like things that are down are things like, we could also, what's the change year over year? Yeah, let's go with, we don't have a month over month change. I think there's actually a chart that'll give us a percentage month over month. Here we go. Yeah, this is much easier. Okay, March 2023 advance. Oh, this is perfect. That's the year over year. They don't actually make this so terribly easy for us. January through March, Jan 2023 through March 23 from. Okay, this gives you the first quarter from the quarter before that and then compared to last year. Okay, let's look over here. Let's see where the weakening is. So furniture and home stores, you actually had the first quarter do a little bit, you had an increase here of about 1.3% compared to the last quarter over here. What's negative? Building materials was negative in the first quarter compared to the fourth quarter. You've got health and personal care stores up 3.1%, gas stations. So it looks heavily weighted here on gas when you just solely look at the headline. But that is why we also have retail sales excluding auto and gas. And that came in at negative 0.3%. So it looks like auto gas really pulled retail sales down substantially. So that'll change next month as well, much like the PPI. So that means the data is potentially not as terrible as it initially appears, because it seems like the big anchor here is really gas. So that's good. Again, the retail sales excluding auto and gas, we were actually expecting a bigger drop there. We were expecting negative 0.6, but we only got negative 0.3. So maybe that actually shows a little bit more strength in the economy than it initially looks like. Because when you first look at retail sales and you see that retail sales advance and excluding auto coming in twice as bad as expected, we initially think, oh my gosh, this is terrible for the economy. But it actually seems like it was natural gas and potentially gasoline that, gasoline stations again, that really pulled this down. So what else do we have on this? Food and service, drinking places. That's probably your largest advance right here. as food service. Then let's see, any other fours here? Now you get a 7.9 over here at department stores. That's pretty big. So you got department stores and food service and drinking places moving pretty well here. But it looks like everything else, clothing, this is barely a movement over a three-month period here, over the fourth quarter to the first quarter. Sporting goods, barely a movement over here. Retail overall, 1.3%. Okay, so let's see if we get a little bit more detail. Then we've got, compared to the previous month, so here's our month-over-month data. This is going to be February or March 2023 compared to February. So let's see what we've got in this data set here. This one shows month over month, where's gas? Month over month, gas was still had some a movement here. So that's interesting because here you've got that negative for the fourth quarter to the first quarter, but you actually had a slight positive here on the month over month going from Feb to March of 0.4% on gas. Here you can see total retail sales, 0.3. This is for retail and food services, different from the current headline number that we just read off. So let's get a little bit more detail here. Let's listen in for a moment on what CNBC is saying. It looks like they're talking about those import prices right now, but let's listen in.
Give me your impression, Austin, of the I guess it should be President Goolsbee now, right?
No, it's Mr. President.
That's Mr. Exactly right.
Mr. President.
And for Joe, that's Air Doctor President Plenipotentiary.
He's made it very clear that I need a lot of respect now.
A lot of respect now.
He said you are
going to treat us,
and I'm willing to do it.
It seems like every time I hop over to them, they just jump around on nonsense here. But quickly, retail, after the retail sales, we saw Treasury yields actually jump. That's interesting. See, there's a lot of confusion around how this initial print came out. See, I'll just read this for you word for word, and it's the same confusion I had. Treasury yields jumped after retail sales contracted more than expected, which seems odd, but sales excluding autos and gas were better than expected, as was the control group. So in other words, the first impression is, oh my gosh, this is terrible. But then when you look deeper at it, it's like, wait a minute. No, this is actually not bad. So what's happening is if retail excluding auto and gas can hold up at the same time as inflation is going away, that's actually a good thing. So forgive how complicated this is this morning, this retail sales report. It's very complicated. But this is actually not a terrible thing. This is suggesting that import prices, which is inflationary, are falling substantially faster than expected. The prior revisions for retail for import prices month over month were also revised towards more of a negative number, although export prices were revised slightly up. Most of the numbers this month were substantially more negative than expected for import and export prices. Actually, all of them were. And then retail sales, once we pull out the gas sector, retail sales are actually holding up. So in other words, better news on inflation. Inflation coming down faster, retail sales holding up a little better. Let's listen to this guy they're trying to interview now.
Prices. There's research out by Chicago Fed researchers reflecting a longer tradition of research that shows wages do not serve as a leading indicator for price inflation. They're a lagging indicator. So when people are looking at...
Duh. This is Goolsbee, by the way, one of the new Fed presidents.
Prices 6 months ago. I think we want to keep our eye on the price series, not on the wage series.
Austin, you said in your, you quoted analysts in your speech saying that the tightening of credit conditions could be worth 25 to 75 basis points of Fed tightening. Do you embrace that? Is that a sort of an arm's length thing?
No, I didn't.
Go ahead.
I didn't embrace it even in that. I said, we don't know. What we need to study is how big is that in a Fed funds equivalent, and that the ranges kind of are all over the place. The median range, I'd call it, from the private analysts is 25 to 75. There are some people, as you know, they were saying 150 and 200. That doesn't seem realistic to me, but it's something. And so if you see credit tightening, you know that does the job of monetary policy. And this moment, sometimes when you're trying to strengthen the financial system and you're looking at either regulatory forcing or the banks themselves trying to strengthen their financial positions in stress, a lot of times that's happening when the economy's in the dumps. And so in a way, your financial stability goals and your monetary policy goals end up fighting each other. But this is not that moment. This is a moment where everything we do to strengthen the financial system to prevent that from snowballing is actually doing the job of monetary policy. So I don't think that they're in conflict at this time.
All right. So not much commentary from this guy here, but some other notes here. The retail sector on average falls by the most in the 6 months after a recession starts. Now, that's actually interesting because, see, we're really trying to set up this understanding of, hey, when the recession technically begins, where is the pain, right? So if we draw sort of a, here's our decline, here's our recession, does everything in the economy sort of get worse or does it get better? Eventually, you come out of the recession, right? Generally, we sort of line or gray bar, we'll use an orange bar in this case, the period of the recession. Eh? And there's this expectation that maybe earnings would bottom right here at the, there we go, that earnings would bottom basically at the start of a recession. That's sort of an expectation that is historically held. There's also this belief that the yield curve uninverts. So the yield curve would uninvert. And then there's also a note that the retail sales sector usually falls for about 6 months into a recession. So retail sales seem to be very cyclically affected by what people's impression are of what the economic state is, right? Retail, again, very cyclical, very, very much follows the cycle, the economic boom and bust cycle. And the fact that we're still getting smashing retail numbers here once we actually sort of extract the gas and auto segment, and we just look at retail sales, which aren't inflation adjusted, but that's okay. They still give us an idea of what's going on relative to the prior month and relative to expectations, and the numbers are weaker than expectations. Well, but when we take out autos and gas, we go, okay, well, that's not actually that bad. Maybe that does sort of align with the bond market and saying, hey, maybe we're still over here, right? Because the bond market is telling us we're still maybe 3 to 6 months away from a recession. We keep hearing people talk about Q3, Q4 for a mild recession. Even the Federal Reserve is now talking about a mild recession here. So could it make sense that March's retail sales data are given that they're still well within Q1 over here, are too early to really indicate any kind of recessionary pain? Yeah, absolutely. The yield curve is not uninverted, so the steepening part is usually the most painful. We still have decent retail sales, but that could be normal. The stock market tends to, at least historically, bottom at the beginning of a recession, which would actually be here. We hope not in this cycle. We hope that in this cycle, the stock market is basically so convinced that a recession is occurring that the bottom of the stock market has actually come before the bottom, as people don't want to miss the bottom. Kind of a psychological impact there. But then we believe also that Goldman Sachs tells us earnings for companies tend to bottom 6 to 9 months after the bottom in stocks, which is interesting because if stocks bottomed, some of them bottomed, let's say, in December, the bottom of their earnings might be in August, which is interestingly over here in around Q3. So kind of a fascinating way to add together some different data points. And of course, nobody really knows exactly what's going to happen. We'll see, but we want to keep an eye on these things. Let's keep looking at what Goolsbee here has to say.
I do not think that some mild recession is definitely on the table as a possibility. I mean, the data show that, and we've raised rates almost 500 basis points in a year. That's historically an indicator of slowing GDP growth. When you get numbers like retail sales and others that are declining, you look at construction, I think we've got to think about what's the state of growth in the country. Fortunately, so the labor market continues to be very strong. And so,
how does your reaction function change, Austin? How does the reaction function change? How do you respond to a recession? There are people who have argued to me that your average Fed official actually has a recession built in everything but GDP by pointing out that you don't get a 1 percentage point increase in the unemployment rate outside of a recession. Does a recession mean you stop hiking? Does it mean you cut?
Well, I mean, let's not start chasing our tail here. It depends. Is this mild recession, if they have it, is that being caused by the raising of interest rates, or is that a recession that's happening because of supply conditions or things that are happening outside?
Austin, I have a question, because whenever the markets get a whiff of the notion that the Fed may pause, that the Fed may actually consider a pivot, asset prices go higher. So to the extent that you care about, or the Fed, does the Fed care about that, that markets take it as a good sign and therefore stock prices will rally? Because what we saw yesterday was very interesting. We saw a risk-on rally. So we saw, for instance, the ARK Innovation ETF rally on the back of this notion that maybe the Fed's going to pivot. That sort of works against what the Fed's trying to do.
It's an interesting point. I think that's an interesting point. I've been publicly saying from the time I took the job and before on this program over the years, I'm not a fan of the Fed tying, let's call it, its mandate or the doing of its job to how does the market reacting. Like I say, Congress gave Fed a job, which is maximize employment, stabilize prices. It doesn't say anything in there about make sure that the markets stay happy or make sure nobody loses any money. And so I'm not a fan of paying close attention to what the market response is going to be.
This guy seems weird. Like, could you imagine if this guy were Jerome Powell? Like, I don't think I would ever buy stocks again.
I mean, you guys said you were going to pivot into raising rates in November of 21, and rates went up, and that was doing your...
Scaring me.
Right now, if you look at the outlook for rates, Austin, they don't believe you. They think you're going to cut, and cut pretty deeply by the end of this year. And so, in a sense, the market is not doing its job for you. So maybe you shouldn't be pandering to markets, but certainly there's some... What's the right word? Symbiosis that's necessary here that you're not getting.
Austin, in the past, the Fed has tried to use the wealth effect to bolster balance sheets and make things better and have stock market go in seriously scary times. It stated zero to bolster the wealth effect to help. So that's why we had a Fed put for so long. You really don't think we've ever done that to try to make things better?
I'm not going to get in an argument about history. I'm going to just say, at this moment, when I say we need to look at what the market is doing for us in monetary policy, I'm talking about credit conditions on the ground for regular, in the real economy, regular businesses. Yeah. If the stock market reacts, so be it. But that's not what I think that the Fed's primary instrument should be right now. It should not be using the wealth effect of stock market wealth to try to steer the economy. I think right now, this credit condition is the...
Plus, the Fed uses the pandemic as an excuse for saying it's zero. Why can't I use that as an excuse for not paying off? You weren't back here. There was a pandemic. So how are we supposed to go to dinner or lunch when there was a pandemic, right? Because there was a pandemic. Did you forget
you
there was
went
a
on
pandemic?
Vacation. All I know,
you,
I showed
you
up,
forgot
you
there
went
was
on
a
vacation,
pandemic.
And you waited me out, Joe. You waited me out, I'm not allowed to sit there. Now
pull
I have
the tapes,
to pay for my
Mr.
own
President.
Dinner,
I'm
and I'm not paying
okay,
to go
Mr.
to dinner
President.
With you.
I'm going to pull the tapes. I'm going to settle this once and for all. We don't have the kind of time to deal with this anymore.
This guy's a jerk. Oh, he's evil. And I don't get it. Like, he's not being funny. He's being mean. This guy's weird. He's scary. Why is he at the Fed? Jerome, what the hell? Oh, my God. Like, he was supposed to give us commentary on retail sales. And instead we got, I don't want to go to dinner with you, Joe. I showed up to do my job and you were on vacation. I'm like, you're a douche. Like, wow. Okay. So, like, I don't even know that I so much care what that guy has to say. One thing I thought was remotely interesting, as much as I'm frustrated by Mr. Foolsby whatever here, is this idea about, oh, well, it depends what caused the recession. Is it basically the cycle that caused the recession, or is it rate increases that caused the recession? I do think that's an interesting point, and it's one that's worth diving into. So there are different recessions that you can have. Let's draw this out so it makes it a little easier to understand, because there's so much going on. Sometimes when we draw it out, it's a little easier. So the two different main kinds of recessions that I think we're talking about here are the idea of, okay, do we have the kind of recession that is now destroying inflation, right? So there's that, we'll call it the recession number one, the inflation destroyer. That's what we'll call recession number one. And then there's the recession number two, which is just the fundamentals are screwed recession, right? Like everything's screwed. Obviously, we would hope and think that the most mild of the two would be the inflation destroyer over here. This would presumably be the more desirable. The reason for that is because that's the Fed's goal. And so if this is the goal, this is the goal. Well, if this is the goal, then obviously when the recession has destroyed inflation, when inflation is destroyed, there we go, then ultimately you can end the recession by cutting, right? And now, like I mentioned yesterday in a video, basically the cancer of inflation is gone. So even though the symptoms are still bad, you have weight loss and hair loss and you're sick and stuff, now the cancer is gone or going away, markets can actually rally. Markets can rally on this kind of, dare I say, pivot. I would call this more of a U-turn, because the Fed is done, right? That's good. So that would be good. In recession number two, you have screwed fundamentals, but at the same time, inflation has not been destroyed. Well, then you have real problems, right? Then you're in the worst case scenario. This is in this scenario on the right, you probably don't want to own stocks right now. And in the scenario on the left, you probably do want to own stocks. So it gives you a little bit of a breakdown on retail sales. And the Fed's reaction to recession. Let's quickly see some more Wall Street reaction here. Looks like, headline retail sales were weaker than expected, even accounting for revisions. The narrow aggregates like control were slightly better than expected. Still, the overall picture is pretty weak. Spending as the first quarter came to an end. Import prices also fell more than expected. Not entirely clear why front-end yields are skyrocketing higher. So front-end yields is a reference to what's going on in the bond market. You've got the 10-year moving up about 6 basis points, and the 2-year moving up about 11 basis points. That is odd. I think maybe that is weird, because technically if you have import prices falling and retail sales not as bad as expected, I could understand this. I know why. Okay. All right. I think I have an understanding. Okay. So import prices falling faster is good for us getting out of that recession, right? Or potentially preventing it, which seems like a long shot at this point. Seems like it's going to happen. But anyway, retail sales being better is good. So you have inflationary numbers coming down with retail sales coming in better than expected. So why would the treasury market potentially send yields up? In other words, why would people potentially be dumping bonds and doing something else with their money? Because maybe they realize inflation is going to be dead sooner than we expect without having to go into a deep recession. It seems like the more people believe we're going into a deep recession, the more they buy bonds. And the more we believe we're not going into a deep recession, the less they buy bonds. That's why during the banking crisis, everybody was jumping in to buy bonds, because they're like, flight to safety, everything's going to hell. And the less the banking crisis seemed like an issue, the more relaxation we saw on some of those plummeting yields on treasuries. And that's why I think we're sitting at about 3.52 right now, as opposed to the 3.32-ish low that we ended up getting to. So very, very mixed picture here. But hopefully that gives a little bit of insight into what actually happened here with retail sales. I would call it a little messy there, but I think we got to the bottom of it. All right, next. We've got many things to cover, so let's see what we want to cover. But anyway, that finishes retail sales. And we'll go ahead and pull up our next seg here. In the meantime, Nike Swoosh going to take a year or more. Yeah, I mean, that's actually kind of been the point, right? That's something that I've been talking about pretty regularly, is that the Nike Swoosh is expected to be a long-term thing, right? This is not V-shaped recovery. So that's something I've been very clear about, is that I think it's a very slow grind up with a lot of volatility in between. I believe that. I think that also helps explain why you see so many stocks that feel like they're almost trading sideways as we're trying to get into this sort of Nike Swoosh environment. I mean, look, for example, at Enphase right now, that trend line looks more of like a downtrend than an uptrend on specific stocks, right? Enphase trading sideways, Tesla's trading sideways. And so I think what'll end up happening is, I mean, this is almost setting up for what looks like potentially it could be a set up for a breakout here on Tesla. So we'll see. If I go, it's maybe not as clear as it looked initially. But let's draw one more here. There we go. Okay. Come on. And let's go with, yeah, I mean, it's entirely possible that Tesla here on earnings is setting up for a breakout. You could almost call these pretty even converging trend here. And if we have an even converging trend, oftentimes you're looking at a heavy, you know, some kind of catalyst or some kind of event that potentially could squeeze the stock either up or down. So we'll see what happens here on earnings, where we get probably the biggest margin hit that we've seen. Although we did get boosted, hopefully, by the Inflation Reduction Act. So we'll see what happens with that $7,500 tax credit, which was in effect for pretty much all of the first quarter, because it just kept getting extended. But I think you see the swoosh a little bit more when you go to higher level indices, right? You see it over here. So we go to the NASDAQ. And there you could more clearly see it. This is the beginning, right? And if this right here is a year, like if think about it, if the tip of the swoosh is a year, I mean, we're going, yeah, a year and a month. You're talking 13 months just to make the tip. You know, this part is probably going to be, you know, 3, 4, 5 years. So yeah, it is not a V-shaped recovery at all. So anyway, here's CNBC actually touching on those yields. Let's listen in for a second.
Not necessarily some sort of catastrophic event. Consumer spending should probably cool in a situation where we're trying to lessen inflation. But note that retail sales did come in negative. I think that yields are up because they were actually stronger than expected when you strip out autos and gas. So there was a little bit of an upside surprise, although still a negative number. I do expect that the consumer continues to pull back on spending little by little as we go. But remember, the consumer can change their mind on a dime. So if things start to worsen, you're going to see consumer spending change quite quickly. As for what the Fed does in May, there's still a lot that's going to happen between now and then. We'll have almost half of the S&P having reported earnings by then, so they'll have a lot more data than what we have today. I think one of the biggest data points between now and then is the JOLTS number, and they'll be watching the labor market very closely. If I had a vote, which I absolutely do not, nobody calls me for my opinion from the Fed, but if I had a vote, I would say it's probably a good idea to pause here and wait for some more data to roll in.
Yeah. Of the bank earnings, which...
Yeah, wishful thinking there. I do not think the Fed is going to pause in May. I think they are going to hike in May and then go away, especially if we've got this fool's begun. I don't know why I'm so bothered. Like, that guy was like a D-bat. I don't know, man. Like, there's no chance he's going to watch this, but in the crazy world that he did, it's like, we're not trying to hate on people here, but the guy didn't come across great in the interview. And I would think about maybe a little more, I don't know, humility there and a little bit more relaxation, you know, like I think I'm the luckiest idiot on the internet. I can't believe people actually watch me, but I try my best. But I think it's awesome, so I'm appreciative of it. Thank you. But that, I don't know, man. That guy's something else. All right, we got to talk about the debt ceiling here. It's a big deal. So we actually just got some news out of it, which is pretty cool. All right. Well, there's a lot of fear and drama and uncertainty and doubt about the debt ceiling, about whether or not the debt ceiling is going to get extended. Are we going to have a massive market crash and capitulation because the recession begins right around the same time that we start fighting about the debt ceiling? We're expecting to hit what's known as the X date between July and September. But before you mark your calendars about July and September, thank you for being here. And we might not actually need to get to July and September because Kevin McCarthy has just revealed the potential ballpark outline of a plan that he has. We don't have complete details of the plan yet. Kevin McCarthy will be showboating about his plan on Monday at the New York Stock Exchange, and we'll be getting more details on his plan. But he did just unveil a plan. And why does Kevin McCarthy matter? Well, because he is the Speaker of the House. The Democrats obviously want to extend the debt ceiling. The Democrats control the Senate. The Democrats control the administration in the White House, Biden administration. As a result, you have Democrats who say, we should just extend the debt ceiling without any limit and no conditions. We should just raise our borrowing authority and allow us to spend more money on whatever we want. If we want to send another couple hundred billies over to Ukraine, we can do that. Well, there's a balance of power again. We have a divided Congress. And Kevin McCarthy on the right in the House says, you know what? We need spending cuts. We can't keep spending like drunken sailors. No offense to sailors. Can't keep spending money like this. And just raising the debt ceiling willy-nilly, we need to start cutting back. And so Kevin McCarthy has been pretty set on not unconditionally extending the debt ceiling. And this has led to a lot of nervousness that, oh my gosh, what if this is the year the United States defaults on its debts, which Jerome Powell, who's the chairperson of the Federal Reserve, says would be a financial catastrophe. Other bankers and individuals, we could play countless people on TV saying it would be hell. The market would crash. We'd be going into a deep recession. The dollar would plummet. Nobody would believe in U.S. treasuries anymore. The petrodollar might explode. China might take over. Everything dies if we don't extend the debt ceiling. All this drama. And quite frankly, we've extended the debt ceiling 78 times before. So it's expected to get extended again, but now we actually have a plan. And so the plan from Kevin McCarthy is the following. We won't raise the debt ceiling. We'll extend the debt ceiling just one more year. We'll have a vote in late May, and we'll vote just to give an extension until 2024. Because yeah, that's not raising the debt ceiling. It's just an extension. It's marketing. It's raising the debt ceiling. Okay. And what we want in order to get that are concessions now and then another set of concessions next May before the election in 2024. Basically, in English, the debt ceiling is probably going to get raised, and it looks like it's actually going to get raised before it even becomes a problem, given that Kevin McCarthy is actually putting on some level of reasonableness by trying to negotiate this earlier rather than at the last minute. So look, from the in the middle point of view here, you got to give some credit to Kevin McCarthy for at least starting this plan earlier. Thank goodness it's not a last minute plan. This is a good thing. So you got to give some credit here. It's possible they're doing this on purpose, even though technically they will be giving in and raising the debt ceiling. It's possible they want Kevin McCarthy to be seen as somebody who's actually bringing stability to American politics, because nobody really trusts American politics. And by bringing stability to American politics, maybe in the 2024 election, people will remember. I highly doubt it. But maybe people remember, Kevin McCarthy wasn't a loose cannon. Maybe Republicans aren't that bad. Right? That, I think, when you're looking at sort of your independent and your on-the-margin voters, that might be a consideration. So really, America as a whole wins because the debt ceiling crisis is postponed before potentially causing massive market turmoil and more uncertainty in an already rough time. Heavily inverted yield curve, which is a signal of recession at our doorstep, a banking crisis, mass layoffs beginning. It's a massive mess. So Republicans here might actually be pulling off a pretty good move. Now, their proposal is that non-defense discretionary spending, NDD, for 2023 is to stay flat and grow at only 1% for the next 10 years. It's basically trying to put a limit on the amount of money the government can spend. Now, let's understand what NDD is because it's a little complicated, but I'll make it as simple as possible. There are two types of spending. Think about it this way. Every week you have to pay, or every month you have to pay your rent and you have to pay your groceries, and you basically have certain mandatory expenses, right? In your own households. These are things you have to spend money on no matter what. That, think of as a mandatory expense. For the government, mandatory expenses are things like Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, unemployment, labor, and they even called pandemic stimulus mandatory spending, which we could debate about that in a different video. Then you have non-defense discretionary. So non-defense just means, let's not talk about the military right now, right? Let's cut that out for a moment. Let's instead talk about the discretionary stuff, which would be your public health, foreign aid, the CDC, transportation, parks, infrastructure, the Coast Guard, the FAA, law enforcement, the IRS, education, K through 12, higher education, sciences, economic security, like low income assistance and grants, basically non-mandatory things. This is where the Republicans are saying we want a cap on basically all of government's choice spending. And there's now a debate in terms of what that cap should be. Now, Democrats haven't yet responded, and obviously they're in control of two-thirds, basically, of the power structure in D.C., the presidency and the Senate, and Republicans have one-third. But you need all three of them to make this happen. So the expectation is there'll be some kind of negotiation around the percentage growth for this non-defense discretionary spending, and it's unclear yet if Republicans are going to force cuts to the military and defense spending segment. Why that's important is because a lot of Republicans are frustrated that it feels like the Biden administration is sending too much money to Ukraine, potentially pushing Putin to the edge of World War III and using strategic nuclear weapons. Whereas Democrats say, no, we have to do everything in our power to support Ukraine. This is an invasion by Russia. This is much more than a territorial dispute. We need to have the battle on with Russia on the Ukrainian battlefield before it expands to Europe and America. So these are, you know, the arguments that are basically being made on both sides. But the bottom line here is we're actually seeing more progress this year in negotiating the debt ceiling increase than we really have ever before. Now, I think that's really awesome. And I also think StreamYard is really awesome, which is what I'm using to record this video with. Check out metkevin.com/StreamYard to learn about StreamYard and the streaming platform that you can use and basically edit videos with and live stream or not live stream, throw up banners like this little paid promotion banner I could throw up. Or if I wanted to throw up a different banner on StreamYard, I could do that. If we wanted to throw up a banner around the bottom talking about my courses on building your wealth and life insurance, we can do that as well. So go to metkevin.com to learn about StreamYard. But anyway, bottom line is, instead of like this last minuting that you've generally been used to seeing in Congress, Kevin McCarthy is actually trying to take a proactive approach here. Now, Democrats will probably end up freaking out about these limits that Kevin McCarthy is trying to impose anyway. So a fight could still happen. This does not mean the debt ceiling crisis is over. But let's just put it this way. We're in April, and we've probably got until September to deal with this debt ceiling crisis. That's about 5 months. And we're already seeing pretty awesome progress on this negotiation. And it gives me confidence that really, as part of the Nike swoosh recovery, the debt ceiling crisis is just going to be another piece of unfounded FUD. The debt ceiling will get extended another year. And ultimately, there are some great opportunities to look at buying stocks. And eventually, there'll be some opportunities, I think, as well, to buy some real estate. And of course, you know, regardless of what the market is, there are ways to make money in real estate. In fact, that's what I started a real estate startup on, is no matter what the market is, you can buy properties below market value, fix them up for less than the difference you're getting in the price. In other words, you're getting a good deal building instant equity in the property and rent them out. Doesn't matter what the market is in that case, which is pretty exciting. still think there'll be a better opportunity to buy come Q3, Q4, but we'll see. Either way, debt ceiling crisis is not one of the things that I personally am highly worried about. And I personally don't think you should either. But then again, even though I'm a licensed financial advisor, this is not personalized financial advice for you. So hopefully that gives a little bit of insight into the debt ceiling. All right. Now we have Zianetta, another topic. Let us see here. So let's take a quick look as well to see how futures are doing, as well as BTC. Oh, wow. BTC is trying to break out again. This is incredible. It's at 30,700 right now. Look at it right here. Yes, aggravated trade. If you hit the join button, if you're watching on a computer, it won't work on an iPad or iPhone. Hit the join button and you can see the different membership options. But yes, the answer is yeah. So, okay. So BTC sitting at 37. This is incredible. Let's jump over to ETH. Wow, 2,100 on ETH. Yeah. You know, yesterday I had some sweet calls on TQQQ, which is the triple leveraged NASDAQ. Of course, when I trade, I send my buy-sell alerts to everybody in the Stocks and Site group. And those were great. I think we pulled off like 35% or something within 24 hours. That was awesome. So hopefully we get some more of those kinds of trades. That was fun. Today... Looks like we're starting the day slightly on the red side. But we'll see if we end up holding here at that 317 level. All right, let's see what else we have to cover. Let's listen in here for a moment.
And that just makes it very difficult to do. And that's the struggle here, Carl, is that if you're Truist or U.S. Bank, you say, well, you know what? I've got a pretty good situation right now with my mortgages.
But you know what? If First Republic were to enter receivership at some point.
Oh, David.
No, listen, just if it were to happen. We're going to have earnings behind us. People are going to feel more confident. It doesn't mean that it's going to cause another leg in a crisis.
No, I agree with that. It's not good. Well, I think what we're seeing today, Carl, is the banks right now are not going to be the reason why the Fed should stay its hand. The banks that we're seeing on our screen, not this, not the regionals, but the majors, they don't make. If you were saying that we think that we should tighten another quarter point, you could say, listen, now it's just a gift. The question is whether we should do half and try to put an end to it. So, I mean, this kind of does wreck the thesis that we had about 3 weeks ago.
Which was
there's such a crisis, they'd be crazy doing it. I still think that there's a big imputed tightening. I am not in favor of a quarter point increase. I don't think that these banks are represent.
Okay, we just guaranteed a quarter point increase.
Goolsbee, you know, he did mention watching credit tightening is certainly one of the key things. But everybody's watching. Nobody yet has the answer in terms of what the impact's going to be.
Well, but if it's tightening, then the growth's not going to be there.
Well, and now in terms of banks that are pausing, we got Singapore last night and South Korea and India and Australia and Canada all on pause. Are we going to join? That's the question.
These countries don't have it as bad. Their economies are nowhere near as strong as we are. Our economy is very strong, but we had a couple of banks that really screwed up, and we have a Fed rate increase that's making people pull back.
Yeah,
they should pull back.
And a continued focus on inflation. There are many who believe it is coming down and coming down materially. Austin Goolsbee, by the way, perhaps amongst them. Take a listen.
Oh, no, I don't want to hear more of this guy. No. Sorry, look, usually somebody from the Fed, I'd be like, oh my God, I want to hear. That's the last guy I want to hear about from the Fed. I don't trust that guy at all. I'm sorry. I rarely say that. I apologize, but we are not listening to that guy again. All right. Jeez, Lord. Let's talk about waves of inflation. All right. So this is going to be a good one. I forgot to schedule the course member live. Let me do that really quick. Course member live. By the way, yesterday we did some really cool analysis. Really, I think if you like want to be exposed to fundamental analysis, but you don't want to actually do it, you just want to like 2x through the lecture, the lives every day. A lot of people do that. People love it. I mean, it seems like it because, I mean, we did some great analysis yesterday on, CarMax and Delta. And it really gives us, in my opinion, some really good forward-looking data into what's going on with inflation. Today, we'll do some more. So we really enjoy that. And I encourage you to join. You can actually get lifetime access either with the Buy Now, Pay Later link down below, or you could also use the join button to get access to those course member lives. Okay, let me quickly post this on Discord. That way y'all have it. And then I want to talk about these waves of inflation. So this is a good one because there's a lot of talk about these three waves of inflation. Course member live, 414, 23, paste. There we go. And we'll put it over here. Usually I post this much earlier. Oh, there we go. All right. So talk about three waves of inflation. I concur. The juicy courses are worth the squeeze. Thanks, not Steve. Appreciate it. All right, folks, let's get into the three waves of inflation. This is a big deal because people are going crazy about this particular chart on Twitter. They are saying we are basically screwed because look, somebody put a blue arrow here and said, you are here. The first wave of inflation is rotating down. And guess what you have ahead of you? Hell followed by hope, followed by more hell. And the world is coming to an end because there are going to be three waves of inflation. And you think you got hurt over the last year in the stock market and you're back in because you have hope. Well, then prepare to get screwed because inflation's absolutely going to ruin this economy. The dollar is going to be worth less than the German mark. And we're going to war with China and Russia is going to start using nukes and the world is over. That's what you generally get when you're on Twitter. It's not actually what I believe. Let's break this down and explain why this is unlikely. Or is it likely? I don't know. We'll explain in this video. But first, when I went on Twitter briefly to explore, I actually saw this, which I thought was really cool. Look at this. Elon Musk liked your tweet. I wrote, unpopular opinion, those who drive distracted, texting, tweeting, trading, should have Tesla FSD force enabled, not disabled. Of course, that led to a bunch of people going, yeah, but then you're just going to encourage bad behavior. Dude, I honestly don't think there's a single person who texts and drives who's like, I'm texting and driving because I have FSD and I can just do it safer. It's like people are going to text and drive whether they have FSD or not. I don't think you're encouraging bad behavior. So people are going to do what they're going to do anyway. It's kind of like, I got something to say. I don't want to do it. So it's not a good thing. I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying people are going to do it. It's kind of like why in some places do people give, clean needles to people? Because they have an addiction and you don't want them to die and you don't want them to throw needles around on the floor and infect other people. So you set up kind of safe spaces for people, right? Again, not saying you want to incentivize people using needles and stuff. It's just the way things are. You know, people are going to do what they're going to do. Anyway, that's a big societal debate we don't need to get into right now because instead we need to be talking about these three waves of inflation. So, are we going to face a 1970s style reanimation of inflation? And that is the big question. And in order to understand this, we really have to understand history. So back in 1965, this inflation crisis of the 70s started. And I'll give you an abridged history, okay? So 1965, the inflation crisis started. Part of it was due to Nixon inheriting the Vietnam War and massive war deficits. You had the guns and butter theory back then, massive spending on the war effort, which ended up being not the best war to be involved in. And in 1972, we ended up expanding Social Security. Nixon came out and said he was a Keynesian. Right, the year before that, he ended up imposing wage and price controls, fueling shortages. And we left the gold standard in 1971. So hold on a second. That was a lot of information there. But what happened was you went from somewhere around less than 2% inflation in the mid 60s to by 1973, 8.8% inflation. Why? Well, big reason was the initial imposition of wage and price controls, which is a fancy way of saying we're going to put a ceiling on how much wages can be. So instead of a minimum wage, it was like a max wage to try to prevent a wage price spiral and limited prices of things like gas during the oil embargo when we basically said, F you OPEC, we don't need you. Prices went through the roof. But because Nixon and other administrations set price controls and prices were limited, what happens? Well, you should remember this from Econ 101. When you set a price ceiling, what you do is you create shortages. That's bad. And shortages mess up and break supply chains. Remember the images of people in gas lines waiting for to get gas at gas stations? Gas was cheap, but instead of paying with your money, you paid with your time. So economically, the impact was actually worse. So you hurt the economy more because now people are paying with their time, not being productive members of society. Free market can't set prices because of these price controls. And so what ends up happening when all of a sudden the economy softens and the government's like, oh, we shouldn't be doing this, and they remove the price controls? Businesses try to raise prices again. So in the early 70s, you had a massive disaster. You literally had more spending via expanded Social Security and a war. You had this removal of wage and price controls now combined with the fact that you left the gold standard. So you destroyed people's belief that government could have any control over inflation. That's really, really bad because it breaks something known as inflation expectations. And inflation expectations would end up proving to be something that the Fed called into credibility questions throughout the rest of the next decade, which is a big problem because if people believe that the Fed has lost control on inflation, and there's basically nothing that can be done to bring those inflation expectations back in, you end up having to force a massive recession to rein in inflation again. That ends up being what happened in the early 80s. But the first wave, again, Vietnam War, Social Security, inflation goes from about 1.6% to 6.5% in a matter of 5 years, and then bumps up another 2.3% in just the next 3 years to 8.8%. It's a big deal. It's a lot of inflation. And at the same time, you started solving the problem of inflation and inflation started coming down. What you ended up having was this reanimation. This right here was caused by the price controls, by the way. So here you have price controls. And now all of a sudden you remove the price controls. You actually let inflation come back because you've removed the price controls because you've created a recession. Now you're in the second wave of inflation. Well, what happened in the third wave of inflation? Well, this gets interesting. See, the third wave of inflation, because these price caps were removed, you actually induced something known as a wage price spiral. And that's really bad. That's actually what here in 2022 and 2023, the Federal Reserve has been convinced that they will never allow happen again because they realized it led to uncontrollable inflation in the early 1980s. To the point where the Federal Reserve had to raise rates to 20% to rein in upwards of 14 to 15% inflation. And that's because wages were rising so quickly, increasing the input costs at businesses. Businesses then raised prices, but because people made more money, people were willing to pay those higher prices. But then businesses wanted to preserve their margins. And because prices went up, people started realizing, oh crap, my wages are going up. Businesses are like, crap, I need to keep raising wages to allow my employees to actually survive. So they get paid even more. The prices get raised again because people are able to afford it. So you get the spiraling up of inflation. And that's exactly what you had during the third wave. And one of the reasons you had that explosion was because inflation expectations were completely broken. So Carter appointed a chairman Volcker in 1979. And Volcker was somebody who actually preferred controlling inflation over low employment. Compared to Aaron Burns, the prior Fed chairperson during the 70s, you actually had a completely different theory. Now, you might think this theory is wild, but the theory in the 70s was we will tolerate more inflation as long as the economy is growing. That is the total opposite of today. It's actually Volcker who started the theory of, no, we cannot tolerate high inflation at all. We must accept higher unemployment to kill inflation. So you had a complete flip-flop at the Fed, not just in how high rates went, but also in strategy. Burns was also somebody who communicated in a way that made him seem like a Nixon shill, that the price controls were normal. And Volcker was somebody who's like, no, we need to control inflation. And he was very straightforward in his communication with the public. And so Volcker ended up raising rates very clearly, forcing a recession, and made it clear that the Federal Reserve would not tolerate inflation ever. And that the only way to restore credibility was to prove that inflation was a number one priority. In fact, yesterday I was reading some of the notes from the 1980s, because you could actually go through the transcripts from the 1980s and go through and see what the Federal Reserve Board of Governors were saying in their meetings at the time of these crises. In fact, take a look at this. Here's one of the notes from August 1980 that I was reading. It seems to me, despite our roller coaster ride, we have not dented inflation expectations very much. I think we have a real groundswell for an explosive development on the side of inflation again. In spite of all we've done, we haven't laid to rest the inflation expectations very much. This is literally out of a 90-page document here I was reading yesterday on page 17. You see them talk about the pain of not controlling inflation expectations and trying to figure out, crap, things are about to get worse. This is terrible. This is word for word what's said at the FOMC meetings. It's really fascinating to read. But how does today compare to the 1970s? Because obviously there are some similarities, right? Some of the similarities would be, hey, then we had the Vietnam War, and today we have this crisis in Ukraine. Then we had a supply shock because of OPEC. We had actually two oil shocks. We had an oil shock in 73 and 79. We don't actually have an oil shock as bad as we did then. Then oil quadrupled and doubled. Today, oil prices are still two-thirds of what they were in 2008. So if you think there's an oil shock today, it doesn't even compare to the oil shock that we had in the 70s. But we did have a supply shock thanks to the pandemic, right? So you have war and you have a pandemic. And you also have printing money while inflation is up. We expanded the money supply in the 70s, just like we expanded the money supply at the beginning of the 2022 era. While inflation was high, we were still printing money. But what are the differences? And are the differences the key here? And the answer, in my opinion, is absolutely. In the 1970s, we faced a wage price spiral where wages were rising faster than inflation and showed no sign of stopping. We do not have that today. We do not have a wage price spiral. We also have the correct monetary stance, inflation over everything. We have very clear communication that inflation is the number one enemy and we're willing to suffer unemployment to get inflation down. We have the same stance as Volcker, not like the mistakes of the Burns administration. We also have a very clearly anchored set of inflation expectations today. And we still today face the structural deflation of innovation that we've seen over the last 40 years, and our money supply is shrinking. So when you combine all of those factors, inflation expectations, structural deflation, lack of stimulus, proper communication, and the proper strategy at the Fed with no wage price spiral, you really can't compare today to the 1970s. So this is one of my beefs with Twitter. Even though I started off with having a like from Elon Musk, which makes me just tingle inside and get all happy, makes me want to tweet more, I have to say, Twitter is the one place to go for content where I could look at things that are taken completely out of context and then make a 10-minute video on them, try to unwind what was the stupidity that was put together in one damn chart. It's a lot of work. This is the kind of stuff I teach in my courses on building your wealth, linked down below. This is why I think it's easy for anybody who watches me to actually become a millionaire investing in real estate and learn about the psychology of money through the programs linked down below. But bottom line out of all of this, do I actually think we're going to face three waves of inflation again? No, absolutely not. Could I be wrong? Yeah, absolutely. Am I 100% going to be right here? No, but I will tell you, I'll be the first to flip-flop and let you know that I was wrong. I don't care about being wrong. I'm willing to be wrong, and I'm willing to share my thesis with you. But I have to say, I get very frustrated when I see stuff like this shared on Twitter, and then I compare it to history, and I'm like, how could you possibly compare then to now without addressing all of the differences? But then again, that's the difference, in my opinion, between the short tweets you get on Twitter and the theory and sort of the longer analysis that you can get on YouTube. And as a result, I hope you subscribe and always come back. Join me either in the videos when I post them or the Meet Kevin Report every morning at some point before the market opens. Thank you so much for being here. Going over the course member live stream now, where we're going to do some fundy analysis. So we'll see you soon. Thanks. Bye.